The world of the first century in the Mediterranean world, in the area that we typically think about when we read the New Testament, the area of Palestine, Israel, was a very different world than our world today. So utterly different, it's extremely difficult to relate to it. And so many things that went on within that world are absolutely repugnant to us. Things that they took for granted, things that were normal for them, things that had existed literally from the beginning of time, at least as far back as most people had any sense of time. And everything that they had been told by their fathers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, everything that had been passed down, was a world that in so many respects had stayed the same. And so they had gotten very used to things that today are absolutely unacceptable to us. But life was the way it had always been, fundamentally. Well, there had been technological changes. Technology had come along and changed a lot of things in detail. But the same overall structure of society was basically as it had been for thousands of years. And not just in Palestine or Israel, but throughout the greater region, throughout the known world of that time. Life, culture, just did not change all that much. I say that because as we've been studying through the New Testament book of James, we keep encountering things in this short book that are set within that culture. James speaks to issues within that culture that you and I have a very hard time relating to. And so we're constantly trying to dig out what the principles are that James wants us to get a hold of, the unchanging nature of God and His will for us, wherever and whenever we live. And so it is tonight as we get into James chapter 5. James, as we have noticed in the course of studying through this book, is a man of God who is blunt in his criticisms of ungodly behavior by ostensibly godly people, or at least people who want to think of themselves as godly, people who have been baptized into Christ, people who have become Christians. Tonight, as we look at James chapter 5 and verses 1 through 6, we find James courageously criticizing rich people, business people. But he puts it in terms that you and I have to cut through from the first century now to the 21st century to try to see how they can apply to us. James writes to Christians, "Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you." You know, when you read what God says here through James, and when you read throughout the Old Testament and New Testament about how God instructed wealthy people and business owners how to treat the people who worked for them, it's easy to understand why business owners might think of God as a bleeding heart liberal. Because what God has said through James here, He's said through other men of God throughout the entirety of the Bible, without exception, without alteration. This kind of complaint or criticism or condemnation by God through His people is like a drumbeat. James is making very strong accusations here. Is he addressing rich Christians or rich non-Christians? Think about that. If you return to chapter 4 of James, and you look at verses 13 through 16, James introduces there the idea of doing business. Then he said in verse 17, "Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins." Well, the people who would know the good they ought to do would be people who know God's will, wouldn't they? And therefore, they would be God's people. So based upon those things, I believe that James is speaking to rich Christians. But how could this characterization and condemnation be true of Christians, even if they are rich? After all, they're Christians. In the Old Testament, God's prophets made the same kinds of statements about the Jews, those people who were supposed to be God's holy people. I think it speaks volumes about how money and power affect even godly people. One of the greatest challenges for you and I here tonight is this. Most of us, like some of the things James has said in previous portions of this short letter, are things that we will almost immediately separate ourselves from. We'll say, well, that's not me. And in this particular case, we'll say, well, I'm not a Christian businessman. I'm not a Christian business owner. I'm not a wealthy person. And probably for 90% of us, 95% of us, that's true. This is one of the challenges in reading through James in particular, because he addresses categories of people and social circumstances that we just don't readily relate to. Maybe what we need to look at here is our situation, relatively speaking, in terms of where we are on the socioeconomic ladder and how we relate to other people, how we treat other people. Keeping in mind that if you are a wealthy person, or if you are a Christian business owner, James is speaking directly to you. In chapter 5 and verse 1, James calls for wealthy people to weep and wail because God will send the miseries of judgment upon them for their conduct, as he describes it in this section. But will they weep and wail due to their lost earthly wealth? Or will they weep and wail because they've come to realize that they've lost heavenly wealth? James identifies four spiritual crimes of rich oppressors. The first thing he says is that they have hoarded wealth. In Luke chapter 12, and in verses 16 through 21, Jesus taught that hoarding, rather than sharing, is sinful. He told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? This then is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God." From a world's wisdom vantage point, what this wealthy man determined to do made absolute sense. From a business standpoint, it would seem foolish not to do what he decided to do. But from a God's wisdom standpoint, it was entirely inappropriate. It took into account no one but himself. There was no thought of, what would God have me to do with this? What has God already instructed me to do with this excess? What would be the God-like thing for me to do with this? No, it was all about himself. It was all about hoarding riches. It was all about himself for his future. In James' time, wealth consisted of money, grain, oil, and costly clothing, as well as property owned if you had the luxury of owning property. But today, wealth consists of land, money, stocks, bonds, houses, clothing, jewelry, art, furniture, major appliances, collectibles, autos, boats, and other things to which you and I will attach great value. All of these things, though, will deteriorate, will lose monetary value, or will be stolen. Think of all of the collections people have gathered with the thought that they could not only enjoy it, but it also would be a great investment. For years, my dad was a stamp collector, and there was a time when trading stamps, U.S. postal stamps, was something that a lot of people were excited about, and like anything else, there were those unique things, those one-offs, those minimal printings, and people could make some very good money, still can. And then there was coin collecting. Same principles were at work. And for a time, there were a lot of people interested, and some good money could be made, and people did. But you know what? Today, stamp collecting and coin collecting, like a lot of other collecting, has gone by the wayside. Well, there's still people involved in it, and there's still money to be made, but not nearly like there was in the past. The monetary value has diminished greatly. So many things are like that we invest ourselves in, that we get so wrapped up in, that we get so excited about, that we become so passionate about, that we spend so much time and money collecting. Jesus made it clear in Matthew chapter 6 and verses 19 through 21 that when these things are in fact our treasures, they displace God. Jesus said, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." James' second accusation is that these rich oppressors had not paid their workers for the work they had done. Can you imagine that kind of environment? Can you imagine going to work for someone today, doing your work, and then coming up for your paycheck, and your employer standing there with his arms crossed just laughing at you, saying, "I'm not going to pay you"? What would you do? Well, if you were in a union, you'd go to your union boss, and the union would get all over him. But if you were in a non-union situation, you'd probably go to the state of California and try to get arbitration, maybe sue the person. But when you lived in the first century, those weren't available to you. Basically, the people here that James is talking about, the people who mowed someone's field, were day workers. These rich oppressors had not paid the workers who had done the work. Why? Why would they withhold their wages? Simply because these wealthy people had the power to refuse. They had taken the money owed these workers and hoarded it for themselves. The workers were powerless people. They had no means of recourse. Their only recourse, really, was to cry out to God for help. And James assures here that these people who had cried out to him and the rich oppressors, God would hear and God would act.
Well, this is so different than our context today, isn't it? How can this possibly apply to us? Even if we were wealthy people, or even if we were Christian employers, how does this have any resonance with us today? Well, could Christians today be guilty of this same principle by refusing to pay their workers sufficient wages for the cost of living, for health care needs, and for retirement? In Colossians 4 and verse 1, Paul told Christian employers, "Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven." And this echoes Jesus' teaching from Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, what we call the golden rule, where Jesus said, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you." James' third accusation is that these rich Christians were living in luxury and self-indulgence. In the mid-1980s, Betty and I were looking for the possibility of going to work for a church in Caldwell, Idaho. And while we were there, one of the things that was said was that at that point in time, the state of Idaho boasted that they had more millionaires per capita than any other state in the United States. What they didn't brag about was, though, that the reason for that was that their working people had the lowest wages of almost any state in the nation. And so these wealthy people had made their wealth on the backs of other people, at the expense of other people. The Greek words that James uses to indicate these people lived in self-focused and immoral lives. That's what he means by luxury and self-indulgence. They lived in self-focused and immoral lives. And the day of slaughter that he speaks of paints a horrible picture of God's day of judgment on them. He speaks of them as though they were the fatted calves who were going to be slaughtered as a sacrifice. This is similar to Jesus' story of Lazarus and the rich man in Luke chapter 16 and verses 19 through 31. The rich man lived in opulence. He was absolutely unconcerned about God or the need of people around him. He knew who Lazarus was, and he knew what Lazarus' needs were, but he arrogantly ignored them. And as the story continues, we find that that rich man, unnamed, paid with his life for that. And it seems the story indicates that he paid eternally in hell for that. So this is no minor thing. This is at the heart of God's heart. Both Jesus and James' indictments on people who know better and yet live in luxury and self-indulgence demand then that we wrestle with some questions personally. Questions like this: have I obtained my wealth in a way that conflicts with God's will and with God's nature? Am I living in luxury and self-indulgence while ignoring the needs of other people? And have these things taken my focus off God and His will for my life? You know, we once again can kind of remove ourselves from James' teachings in this short section by simply saying, well, I'm neither wealthy nor an employer, therefore what James says doesn't apply to me. But does it? In principle, does it? James' final accusation is one that is almost unthinkable. It's hard to imagine this could be possible, because he accuses rich Christians of murdering innocent people. How could a person possibly consider themselves a Christian and yet go about murdering innocent people? But maybe the biggest question is, why? Why would they do this? 1 Kings chapter 21 tells of Jezebel, Queen Jezebel. She had a man by the name of Naboth killed so that her husband, King Ahab of Israel, could have a small piece of land adjacent to his palace for a vegetable garden. Why did she have the man killed? Because Ahab had gone and spoken to the man who was growing a vineyard there, and he told the man, I'd like to have your vineyard and I'd like to grow a vegetable garden here. Sell me the vineyard and I will provide for you a much larger property where you can have your vineyard. And the man said, no, I can't sell what has been my family's inheritance. You see, all the land that the people had in Israel and Judah had been decided and given by God to his people by tribe and then by family. If this man gave up what had come from God, he had no guarantee but that what he would get as a replacement could be taken away from him later. The story goes that Ahab went home sullen and upset because he couldn't have this small piece of land adjacent to his palace. We would put it in different terms today, wouldn't we? We would say Ahab was having a hissy fit. And when his wife, Queen Jezebel, saw this, she said essentially, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it. And she arranged to have Naboth killed. Not the need, there was no need, it was just personal greed. This exemplifies what rich Christians did in James' time. It wasn't a matter of need, but of greed. This kind of activity brought destruction on Israel and Judah eventually. It's what drove them into captivity. It's what God used to cause the tribes and the people around them, the nations around them, to destroy them. Christian employers can take advantage of their workers to such a point as to kill them, whether it's stress or unnecessarily long hours or other things. After instructing Christian slaves to respect their masters, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 9, and masters, treat your slaves in the same way. In other words, with respect. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. It's easy to find illustrations of injustice or oppression of employers upon employees. But someone will point out circumstances that we may not know about, kind of like Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story. In some cases, they may be correct, that we don't know the rest of the story. And we may have cried injustice way too soon. But in other cases, injustice and oppression are in fact present. And in such cases, greed was victorious over godliness. James is not saying that wealth is sinful, nor to be an employer is sinful. And he's not saying that all wealthy people act unjustly. He is saying that the desire for wealth and a craving for more will steal a person's soul and will cost them their eternal life. Paul told Christians in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 9 through 10, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Wealth can become a replacement for God if, in fact, we put our faith in wealth instead of in God. So Paul spoke directly to rich Christians later on in the same chapter, 1 Timothy chapter 6, and in verses 17 through 19, saying, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. Boy, don't we know that today. But to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of a life that is truly life. In Think Magazine, well, let me back up here for a moment. In Matthew chapter 16 and verses 24 through 27, Jesus stated a basic principle for every Christian. For every Christian, whether employer or employee, whether rich or poor, or anywhere in between. And he says this: if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. Jesus says some things there that involve a lot more than we have time to get into tonight. But he poses some questions there that each of us has to wrestle with. And they directly affect the things that James has talked about here in James 5. What if we become exceedingly wealthy? What if our corporation grows to be dominant in the world? If we gain the world and lose our souls, what indeed have we gained? In Think Magazine, Jim Palmer made this observation: we need to think clearly about ways to develop an integrity that will promote Christ and our love for Him over and above any greed or desire for more that may hinder our relationship to our Maker. If you're a Christian employer, you need to probe what or who has shaped your thinking about how you do business, about how you justify your conduct, and what your focus is on in your business. All Christians are servants of God. Paul makes that eminently clear in these remarks he's made both in Ephesians and in Colossians. So our business must be conducted in a way that serves and glorifies God in all ways. All we have comes from God. We're accountable to God for all we have. And all we have is within God's control. This section in James, chapter 5, verses 1 through 6, impresses God's coming judgment. It's a recurring theme throughout the New Testament. No time frame is set upon it because none can be, but simply the awareness that there will be a time. And no matter how short or how long we live in this world, we one day, all of us, will stand before God and be judged by Him on the basis of our words, our thoughts, and our actions. It forces rich Christians, though, and Christian employers in particular, in light of what James has said here, to ask themselves, will I be ready to give an accounting to God of my actions toward my employees? Whoever we are, Christian or non-Christian, we have to ask ourselves, am I ready now to account to God for everything in my life? If there's anything amiss in your life that you know needs God's help, well, what wouldn't be? And you'd like to have the prayers of this congregation or the aid of this congregation in any way, we urge you to come forward now as we stand and sing this song.
God's hand that leadeth me. He leadeth me, he leadeth me, by his own hand he leadeth me. His faithful